There's a difference between a healthy microbial community in terms of like ecology and a microbiome that is healthy for a human being or for a host, if you will. I think that was sort of like the first underlying principle that we came about, that, you know, there's like concepts like resilience and diversity, which are inherently positive for a community of microbes, but or sort of like, you know, concepts like antimicrobial resistance, which in itself is really good for a microbial community, but is seen from like a host perspective, that's not necessarily a good thing for the host.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics. We're a non-profit scientific organization, also known as ISAP. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. In our podcast, you'll hear about emerging topics across the fields of biotic substances and microbiome science. I hope you enjoy this episode with your hosts, Professor Colin Hill and Professor Daniel Tancredi.
Hi, everybody. My name's Colin Hill.
And I'm Dan Tancredi.
And today's guest is Raffaele Jos from Cork, or at least originally from Germany, now from Cork. And Rafa, I should declare to start with that we already know each other. So you've been here in APC for several years. And in fact, the main paper we're going to talk about, examining the healthy microbiome concept, is I'm a co-author on that, although a very minor author compared to the contributions that you and Angus and Paul and others made. So just to set the scene there, that we know each other already. You're a PhD student working here at APC Microbiome Ireland. And as far as I remember, you're the first PhD student we've had on. And so can you give us some background as to where you did your training, what your expertise is, and how you came to be involved in this paper?
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, thank you so much for having me. I'm honestly honored to be here. Yeah, how I came to be on this paper is remarkable, really. I actually have a background in psychology, really. My undergrad I did in the Netherlands, and it was, in pure psychology, really. And during the scope of that, I got to go to Melbourne, where there was a huge exhibition at the time from Felice Jacka, which was on gut health and gut brain. And it just captivated me straight away. And I remember coming back from there and thinking, this is exactly what I want to be doing. This is exactly where the future should go for me. And so, I looked into how I could get to gut health from psychology, which turned out to be quite complicated. But I got accepted to a master's program in London at King's College. And that was really the start of the whole microbiome journey for me. It was really exciting, really challenging at times to like completely shift subject, if you will. And to be one of the only ones who was not a microbiologist also. I think that was quite funny for people at times. But and then after, I just knew I had to stay in the microbiome field. I just knew I wanted to delve even deeper, and knew also that APC microbiome was one of, not if the most important European centers for gut health and the microbiome studies. So I applied for jobs. I applied for a postdoc position and got rejected. But then the PI actually got back to me and said, you are so brave applying for a postdoc if you don't even have a PhD yet. And I like your bravery. So you might get the position as a research assistant instead, if that's okay. And I was like, oh, absolutely. That's so fair. So that's really my journey academically. And from then on, was in the APC as a research assistant and joined the project that where this paper comes from as a research assistant also. And then shortly after started my PhD. And now we're here.
The group, the project you joined is the International Human Microbiome Consortium, or Human Microbiome Action was the name of the particular program. Can you tell us something about that and how that came about?
Yeah, so I think there was really like a need to create like a European-based collaboration project, because there's loads of amazing centers in Europe that do great research, but there wasn't an awful lot of communication in between. And also, I think microbiome science in itself also came to a point where there was lots of amazing studies, but there wasn't a lot of standardization, if you will. And this collaboration project really came around in the need, or yeah, with the wish to create sort of like a consensus in lots of different areas around microbiome science. So like, you know, methodology and also how we use clinical data attached to it and how we analyze microbiome data and how we even obtain microbiome data. And yeah, and as part of it, how to define a healthy microbiome was, you know, really like an important sort of pillar of creating such standardized European microbiome protocols also, I suppose.
Rafaela, you and I have in common that we were psychology undergrads. So, and I went into statistics and you're using really innovative statistics for your dissertation. To set the stage further, can you talk to us about this amazing paper that you first authored that talks about what a healthy microbiome is and especially how we think of as healthy for the human isn't, may or may not be healthy for the microbiome and vice versa?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's really the need, as I explained, came more from like creating a consensus around what is a healthy microbiome. And a consensus obviously involves a quite large group of people to agree on a subject, which we try to obtain by inviting a varied range of experts in the field from all over the world, really, in all of like different sort of microbiome niches, if you will. And yeah, to get them in the room together and discuss what they think is a healthy microbiome, which was, Colin was there. It was really interesting and quite messy at times because it is inherently difficult to define what a healthy microbiome is. I think studies have done a formidable job to see, you know, what role it plays in disease and if there's any differences in that. But I think philosophically, nearly, there's so many different levels of how to define a healthy microbiome. And as you just said, I think the first one to start with is there's a difference between a healthy microbial community in terms of like ecology and a microbiome that is healthy for a human being or for a host, if you will. I think that was sort of like the first underlying principle that we came about that, you know, there's like concepts like resilience and diversity, which are inherently positive for a community of microbes, but or sort of like, you know, concepts like antimicrobial resistance, which in itself is really good for a microbial community, but is seen from like a host perspective, that's not necessarily a good thing for the host. And that's, you know, like a huge pressing issue that research is trying to focus on. So
I love that example because it's not just bad for the host, but for the community of host. But that's like one of my favorite examples of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's, you know, there's lots of different levels that we sort of like dissected that definition on. And I think the next one would be, you know, how do we even define health quite broadly? Is it like, you know, I think the World Health Organization says it's the absence of disease, but is there really such thing? Is there really one human being that has no disease whatsoever? Or, you know, say, can we say, even if you don't have a disease now or, you know, any condition now, does that mean that you won't have any condition in the future? Or is that something that already manifests in your body, in your genes, in, you know, whichever now, or even in your microbiome, I suppose. So there's just lots of different levels that we realized quite difficult. But the underlying thing is that how it's handled right now in microbiome science, it's very functional, but it's quite basic and it's quite exclusive, if you will. And I suppose the main sort of issue we came about with was it needs to be more inclusive. It can't just be a healthy microbiome, can't just be in a person that has no health condition. It has to be also in a person that has a health condition, or it has to be in a child where, you know, no evident condition has emerged yet. A healthy microbiome could be in any person, really. And in order to come to such, you know, definition, we need to just observe and not define. I think that's the main issue that we sort of realized.
Yeah, I've often thought that, Rafa, that let's say you take the microbiome in people with IBD or people with colon cancer or something is radically different and measurably different from people without that disease. But we don't know that the microbiome in somebody with IBD is preventing the IBD from being a lot worse and therefore is actually healthy in the sense that it's trying to fight the disease. It could, of course, do the opposite. It could be driving the disease. We don't know. We don't have causality. So that's always bothered me a bit, that people are showing difference and then just simply assuming that difference is somehow a disease driver or maybe even causing the disease. How was that kind of addressed by the group?
I think there was a real sort of like the only real consensus everyone, you know, sort of like came down with was we need studies that track people and sort of like follow people long term, because only then can you sort of see if say you followed a child from like infancy or like through adulthood and you sort of like track the health conditions or health states, you know, which are quite dynamic inherently that this person comes in and out of. Only then can you sort of like pin which microbiome signatures sort of, you know, attach to those health and disease states. And it might be different that like, you know, while say a child has an infection, their microbiome signature or their microbiome community might be quite different to like a few weeks after. And that's obviously also something that compounds the whole issue of creating such universal definition, because there's so much variability and dynamic sort of, yeah, composure of a microbiome that it's quite difficult to just track the one that fits all. It needs to be something that's longitudinally created and that sort of like emerges from really long-term studies. So yeah, I suppose the one thing that was, you know, really important that we tracked down as a group was we need really long longitudinal studies that track people all the way. And yeah.
And big cohorts, well, I presume.
Huge cohorts, yeah. Just to make sure that, you know, everyone is included in such a definition of a healthy microbiome and not just a certain group that has no health condition or like a certain group that's in, you know, the Western Hemisphere. It needs to be across all different geographies and across all different populations, even ethnic minorities and all sort of like populations that have not been sampled yet so far. So,
and that includes the microbial communities themselves. It doesn't just have to be the gut. One of the other cool things about your paper, the team's paper there, is that we often say composition and function, like put those together. But when you said what we really need is that large cohort study, you did point out rightly that preferably we would know more about the function. Like we really need to get better at knowing the function itself, because compositions can be different, but they could have achieved the same functional goals. So can you talk to us about what you're doing for your dissertation research and other research with regard to understanding more about function?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, yeah, what you were just alluding to is something that the research community refers to as functional redundancy. So you might have two entirely different microbial communities in terms of which exact microbes are in, but their functional or metabolic outputs or their functional capacity can be quite similar, in fact. And I think, you know, that's something that has sort of like emerged over the years from microbiome science, but is still quite difficult to sort of track. And it also includes like, that starts from how we sequence microbial data. There's lots of, you know, difficulties around that, and it's a lot more cost effective to sequence on like a composition level. But the functional level is something that sort of helps us to bridge the gap between different nations and different populations, because it really is a bit more unified and sort of like tackles that problem that we have in terms of inter-individual variability. So my research specifically, I only look at functional data, really. I sort of take the composition as like a fact check just to see, you know, would the composition sort of match with other research in the field. But my focus is really on, is a microbiome functional profile, is that different between different groups? And in my case, do factors like feeding influence a functional profile? And how do we sort of pin those down?
And you know, when we started sequencing human genomes, I thought, and I think many people thought, there was just going to be an answer to everything. It was going to fall out of the genetic sequencing. And then I think we transposed that mistake to the microbiome and said, we sequence everything, we'll be able to tell exactly what's going on. And in neither case really has it identified the kind of smoking gun responsible for different diseases or so on. Do you think we have to move beyond? Like the other day I had my blood tested. And the clinician was able to give me back, this is the low, this is the high, this is the median, this is where you are. And he or she wasn't able to tell me you're healthy because of that. But able to say these biomarkers are within the range for health. What do you think those biomarkers are going to be for the microbiome? Are they more likely to be metabolomic biomarkers than even gene ontologies or gene functions? Or yeah, as Dan said earlier, the like taxonomic structure. What do you think the biomarkers will be that we'd be able to say, yes, you're within a range that we consider to be healthy?
I think that's a really interesting question. I think there was a real wish that we could have a taxonomic biomarker. And I think over the past, literally maybe even just 2 or 3 years, people have sort of accepted that that might not happen just because it's too simplified and those communities are way too complex and there's too many sort of overlapping and interlaced microbial processes that go on at all times. So I think it might be too simplified to just choose the one microbe or the one species or the one genus, if even to, you know, sort of pick out. I think it might be more going into a metabolomic sort of signature or, yeah, sort of measuring like what metabolic outputs your microbiome produces and if that sort of falls in like reference ranges. I think there's still a lot to be said about the microbiome is a little bit of a black box. I think we're doing the most we can with the means we have technologically. But even over the last 10 years, there's been a huge change in, you know, what we were able to do and what research has been able to achieve. And I think if we continue with that speed, like incredible things will come out of microbiome science within the next 10 years. I hope in the near future of, say, 5 to 10 years, there will be a biomarker that sort of helps to just jump those hoops of like time restrictions that you sometimes have in clinical diagnosis, because once you take all those data in, I mean, that's where blood tests were really created, to have like a quick sort of like look into your general health. And I hope that the microbiome could be that for science, because it's just remarkable if it really worked, really.
And do you think this will be almost just curiosity based? Like, let's suppose we do this large cohort study and do it over time. And we find out that, yes, you can predict based on a microbiome readout of somebody in their teens that they're going to develop some disease in their 20s or 30s, or at least the disposition is there. And we have reached that with, I assume, some genetic diseases. They can predict or stratify people for risk. What good is that if we can do nothing about it? What can we do to manipulate microbiomes back into a healthy state if they're in an unhealthy state? Was that a topic at all that was considered?
I think briefly, I think that's probably where, you know, organizations like ISAP come in, because there is really like lots of potential that we have with dietary interventions and prebiotics and probiotics. There's lots of studies showing amazing modulation, one coming literally just out of our own house a few weeks ago, where we literally show that dietary modulation of certain risk groups, you know, eradicates such risk, which is honestly just remarkable. And I think there's lots to be said about, can we add probiotics into sort of food products that we're already consuming anyway? And I think that's a message that's sort of being perceived by the public already. I think they were really open to it. And I think people really would love to engage more in these sorts of health behaviors, if that makes sense. I think there's a new generation coming that's really health conscious and that loves to, you know, take measures into their own hands and personalize their health journeys. And as, you know, part of that generation, being told that you're part of a risk group that might develop a disease in like a few decades or a few years even, I think it could be really powerful to have dietary interventions set out, or even just to communicate it in a way where the individual can then take power back and say, okay, if I know I'm at risk, I can implement certain strategies, dietary strategies that would help me mitigate the risk.
Yeah, Colin's question is interesting, because one of the things you talk about is the microbiome as a reporter of human health. And you point out that things like diversity and resilience of the microbiome don't necessarily speak to an immediate health readout for the human. But you could imagine that diversity and resilience of the microbiome in the teen years might speak to the human's overall long-term prospects. So I would imagine you're probably not just looking for a single candidate of a microbiome marker, but lots of different candidates, or at least I hope you are. What are some that you're thinking of? Colin was wondering if like metabolomic type outcomes would be the readouts, but what are the some that you have a little bit of a hunch might be worth pursuing?
I think there's lots to be said about things like, you know, immune responses and the gut and what role it plays. I think all the diseases people have been looking at in terms of the microbiome have or fall under like a big umbrella of metabolic conditions. And obviously that makes sense, because the gut is the main metabolic organ. So that's, you know, absolutely clear. But I think if we could sort of tease apart how much of the metabolism is sort of like, you know, stirred by the human or by its host, and how much is actually just done by the microbiome itself, I think that could be really, really powerful. So sort of having like a system, I think systems biology is actually really interesting for delving into those sorts of like huge metabolic nets, where you can kind of tease apart how much the microbiome actually influences, say, an immune response or a metabolic output. And having that sort of quantified, I think, could be really powerful when you look at diseases like diabetes and insulin response and all those sorts of levels, and to see kind of like, is your microbiome adapted to the lifestyle that you lead? And is your microbiome helping you as a host to achieve that health? Like, there's, say, if you had a condition, is your microbiome fit to help you live despite having that condition? And I'm not sure if it really comes down to the one biomarker. I think, yeah, as I said, it might be too simplified, but I think if we could sort of quantify in a metabolic way, if a microbiome is suited to your lifestyle and your overall like health condition, I think that would be remarkable, be amazing.
Probably one of the most important windows in human life in so many ways is, you know, literally the few days and weeks and months after birth. And that's, babies are born essentially sterile and they start to accumulate a microbiome from the moment they're born. During birth, they start to accumulate a microbiome. And how kind of stochastic or programmed do you think that is? You know, do you think it's you encounter Biff first and therefore Biff becomes a kind of a bedrock species in your gut, but I encountered Enterococcus first and that became a bedrock species? Or do you think inevitably the Biffs will overcome the Enterococci in me, no matter, you know, that the scheduling of when I meet these bacteria? How important do you think that phase of life is? And I know your research is looking into that kind of area.
Yeah, I was just going to say that's sort of like the main focus of my PhD, to look at, you know, those first 2 years of life and how a microbial community assembles, if you will. So yeah, to your question, I think there's a few things that happen inevitably in every human's life. And a huge part of it is how we're being fed for the first couple of months. And I think because of the way we're fed, so say, I mean, most babies are fed with milk exclusively until they're, say, like 3-4, we usually hope a bit longer, but like definitely for like 4 months. And because the microbiome plays such a vital role in metabolism, it's absolutely clear to me that there must be some sort of dominance of Biff because we receive so much milk in like those first couple of months. So I think there's a few sort of like canon events that happen over the first year that everyone goes through. And sure, there will be sort of like minor differences in, you know, your environment and if you have a pet or if you have siblings and if your parents, I suppose, are, you know, a bit stricter when it comes to licking keys or if they're a bit more lenient to let you play outside. And I think there's lots to be said about, yeah, how much exposure you get in the first couple of months. But with the microbiome being a primary nutritional metabolic sort of machine, the feeding component is huge, and you cannot escape the fact that you will have a dominance of Biff in those first couple of months. I think that's something that has been sort of shown in varying degrees all over the globe and is something that is quite well accepted now at this point, that the Biffs are the pillar of an early life microbiome. And then the first shifts sort of happen when you start introducing solids, because that inevitably is the time when dietary sort of like habits branch out a bit more, and lots of different nations around the globe feed different substrates. And then that's when you see like, yeah, different sort of like branches that evolve based on composition. But I think even then, there's been lots of research showing that even across the globe, there is a microbial signature or like an assembly signature that quite linearly sort of evolves throughout different nations and populations.
What aspects of development are you looking at with your infant studies? Is it neurodevelopment, the development of the musculoskeletal system? Like, what can you talk to us about? What are the things you're looking at?
Absolutely, yeah. So one, as I just said, is infant feeding. So how infant feeding shapes the assembly of a microbial community in kids. And the other really big part is to sort of tie in my undergrad and my previous expertise and interest. It is looking at how the microbiome is involved in neurocognitive outcomes. So in doing that, I suppose I want to sort of see, can we see very early on within the first couple of months of life, how a child evolves in the first sort of like 3 to 4 years of life cognitively? So could we sort of already see in the microbiome of a 2 months old that they will have, I don't know, a condition like ADHD, or if they need some sort of help cognitively or with like emotional skill set, whichever, at the age of 3 and 4? And it's honestly quite surprising to myself. I think, you know, the gut-brain axis is something that is obviously really sort of gaining traction, and that's come like a long way, but it's still coming from psychology, which is often regarded as such a soft science, to a hard science such as microbiology. Seeing that it still translates, and still seeing that there's like a literal microbial signature in those kids, that was something that, yeah, was really fascinating to me from the start, and still, yeah, is really captivating to me.
Rafa, that's just been amazing chatting to you, and you're a tremendous advocate for the work you're doing, and the paper in particular. I think we must have you back once you've done some more of your PhD research to see how that's all going to work out. But thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're looking forward to more great impacts from your research and following you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from ISAP. Check the show notes for links and further information on this topic. You can also send us your feedback, questions or topic suggestions by emailing info@isapscience.org. Don't forget to follow or subscribe to this podcast so you never miss a new episode.